Welcome to Dialogue Across Difference, an event series hosted by the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs. Join us as Center Director Larry Jacobs and guests engage in conversations across the political and policy spectrum on issues of the day.
I'm Larry Jacobs. I direct the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Public Affairs, University of Minnesota. Before we begin, I just want to give you a heads up. At the bottom of the screen, there's a very sneaky Q&A button there. Please click that, give us questions. We love questions. We are going to incorporate as many questions as possible into our conversation this afternoon. Thank you and welcome for joining us to today's program, Madam Speaker, a book talk with author Susan Page. Susan Page is the Bureau Chief for the Washington Bureau Chief for the USA Today. She's covered 11 presidential campaigns. She's covered 7 White House administrations. She's interviewed the last 10 presidents. That is quite a record. She's also the author of a terrific book on Barbara Bush, which I highly recommend, and most recently, author of Madam Speaker about Nancy Pelosi. This has been on the New York Times bestseller list and is widely read and really admired for the insight and the remarkable access. Susan Page is one of my favorite reporters. She's got a nose for the big story and knows how to go and dig out the information she needs to tell it. She's joined today by my good friend and colleague, Catherine Pearson, who's an associate professor at the University of Minnesota in the Political Science Department. Her research focuses on Congress and gender, and Catherine Pearson will be moderating today's conversation. Catherine?
Great. Larry, thank you so much. And Susan, thank you so much for joining us. It is really my pleasure to moderate this discussion with Susan Page. My scholarly research focuses on party leadership in Congress and women in politics. And before I got my PhD, I actually worked on Capitol Hill and had a bit of a chance to observe then Representative Pelosi in action in the 1990s. So I've been following Nancy Pelosi's career for a long time, but I learned so much from this incredible book and thoroughly enjoyed it. Indeed, it's impossible to understand congressional politics and American politics over the last 2 decades without understanding Speaker Pelosi's role in the legislative process and in electoral politics. And it is fascinating to learn about her Baltimore roots, her life before Congress, her family, and other influences on her career. I would highly recommend Madam Speaker to all. And I will start by asking Susan about several topics that she covers in the book and then move on to today's political debates and audience questions. So to start, Speaker Pelosi has represented San Francisco in Congress since 1987, but she learned about politics from her Italian immigrant political family in Baltimore. Please share the influence of her Baltimore roots as you do in the book, and then I'll ask you to share the significance of San Francisco politics as well.
Well, Catherine, it's my great honor to be here. I'm so glad to be at the University of Minnesota in the Hubert Humphrey School. And to be talking with you and with Larry Jacobs, if I'm one of his favorite reporters, he is one of my favorite professors. He always brings a smart perspective when I've called him for his help working on a variety of stories over the years. And I look forward to his new book, which comes out next month, on the impact of direct primaries on our democracy, the unintended consequences of moving to direct primaries. That's coming out next month by Oxford University Press. So, you know, the thing about Nancy Pelosi is, I think there are a lot of Americans who think of her as a San Francisco liberal, and she is definitely a San Francisco liberal, but she is also in her heart a Baltimore Paul. Her father was the legendary Tommy D'Alessandro Jr., who was a 3-term mayor of Baltimore and a big figure in the days of FDR in Baltimore politics. And her mother also, who was known as Big Nancy, contrasted with her daughter, who was known forever as Little Nancy was herself a political force of real consequence. So Nancy Pelosi grew up as the youngest daughter in a big family, six older brothers, and a time when politics in big cities like Baltimore was a contact sport. She grew up in a milieu where her father referred to FDR as the boss, and where John Kennedy came to visit to do an event with her dad when she was in high school. So definitely these are the forces that taught Pelosi about politics and about power.
Great, thank you. Before Pelosi became Democratic whip in 2001, she had a very active legislative career in Congress that few really know about today. She was a legislative entrepreneur on HIV/AIDS, represented her constituency in San Francisco on issues like the conversion of the Presidio. She was very active on human rights in China. She was a member of the Appropriations Committee, and she was definitely to the left of her party. And I think some of these things surprise people today. So if you could talk about her early years in Congress and what she did and the challenges she faced and how that prepared her, or maybe it didn't, to be a party leader.
Well, as I said, definitely a liberal in the tradition of San Francisco politics. She won a special election to get elected to Congress in 1987. It was one of those crazy San Francisco elections with 14 different contenders, many of them representing peculiar third parties. And she defeated several candidates who had more political experience than she had. She defeated them in that primary, interestingly, in part by appealing to Republican voters. Her appeal to Republican voters, which was pretty sly, was, you know, a Democrat's going to win this seat. I am less offensive to you than these other Democrats. And she won that primary narrowly and has, of course, never again had a serious challenge to her reelection in San Francisco. But her big issue when she got elected was HIV/AIDS. And I think it's easy to forget now how in 1987, there was this huge stigma attached to the AIDS issue. And most members of Congress and the President of the United States generally refused even to discuss this public health crisis that was going on. But of course, the center of the AIDS epidemic was in San Francisco. It was the number one issue she had promised voters she would address if they elected her. And she did. She spoke about AIDS during her first remarks on the House floor, to the dismay of some of the other members of Congress who were there with her. And she really pursued it in a serious way. One, you know, that the AIDS quilt, which we all know about, a big community project that has commemorated so many lives lost to AIDS. Well, the first time the backers of the organizers of the AIDS quilt wanted to spread it on the National Mall, they couldn't get permission from the Reagan administration to do that. And it was Nancy Pelosi, who had only been in Congress a few months, who dragged in officials to her office and spoke to them as though she had a lot of power, which she didn't really have, and arranged a compromise that enabled that AIDS quilt to be unfurled on the National Mall. And from then on, she has had a really excellent relationship with activists for AIDS and HIV/AIDS. She was a liberal also when it came to the Iraq War. I mean, look ahead. Nancy Pelosi was the most senior Democratic official to oppose the Iraq War from the start. But this heritage, I think, is sometimes obscured by the fact that now she's in the leadership. And for years, she has been the one making pragmatic deals, taking half a loaf when you couldn't get a whole loaf. And this has put her at odds with today's leading progressives, people like AOC and Ilhan Omar, the new breed of women and progressives on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I see that with my students who see Pelosi as an institutionalist and not someone who's a liberal fighting the power structure. It is interesting. And this, you know, her early years were a long time ago. She's been in politics. But sort of thinking about those early years, as I said, I worked on the Hill in the 1990s, and she was clearly a very active legislator, but she was not someone that people were saying, oh, she's the next Democratic Party leader. So if you could talk about her rise to the leadership. I mean, she was by the time she started her three-year campaign for whip. But sort of what changed from Pelosi, the legislator appropriator, to this path to the party leadership? And when did that happen?
So Catherine, I'm just interested, you've studied this. So tell me, what was your view of Pelosi back then in the 1990s as a staffer looking at her. How did you view her?
And to be clear, I did not work for her. I worked for actually two different congresswomen, one who had a pretty good relationship with her, one who did not. Neither were close to her. But she was viewed as a serious legislator, someone who was very active, often, you know, on the floor, introducing bills, and then an appropriator, but definitely a very liberal San Francisco Democrat. I mean, someone who was a member then, of the Progressive Caucus. She withdrew that membership once she was in the leadership, but, you know, not someone who political scientists would sort of talk about back then as being sort of in the middle of the party and therefore the most likely to be a party leader. And then also, of course, she was a woman and party leadership at that time, that mainly white and men.
Yeah, mainly white men. And when she announced her campaign, or when there was, this was before she had announced her campaign for whip, but when there was some speculation brewing that she was going to challenge the lineup of men who were all prepared to move into the next step in the leadership whenever it was available. One of the men in the leadership came to her and said that, "We understand you and the women have some issues you care about. You don't need to run for the leadership. Just tell us what those are and we'll take care of them for you." And you can imagine that this did not sit particularly well with Nancy Pelosi and did not dissuade her from running and from, in fact, defeating Steny Hoyer, the congressman from Maryland, who thought he was next in line for a whip. So, you know, it's interesting, Catherine. I don't know if you would agree with me on this, but I think the fact that she was female was a bigger hurdle for her getting into the leadership than the fact that she was more liberal than the Democratic caucus as a whole then. Do you think that's true?
Yes, I do think that's true, because certainly, even though sort of you think of the speaker as being someone more in the middle, like a Foley or a Gephardt, certainly the leadership reflected the range of ideological diversity within the party. But I think being a woman was a huge impediment back then.
You know, I don't know if everyone remembers. It seems ridiculous today, right? Because now we have a woman as vice president and a woman who served as chairman of the Federal Reserve. And it seems ridiculous that at the time Pelosi was elected to the leadership, no woman had ever been elected to one of the senior leadership positions in Congress, in the whole history of the Congress. And that was, it's not like that was so long ago, but the women who did these groundbreaking roles, and this is actually, these are the kind of women I've been interested in writing books about, women who broke new ground as first lady, as Barbara Bush did, or as a member of Congress as Nancy Pelosi, or as a journalist as Barbara Walters did. That's the book I'm working on now. They face the kind of hurdles that I think even a generation later are just hard to imagine.
I think that's right. And I think for my students, it's hard to imagine too. And so that's why, you know, it sort of takes me by surprise when my liberal students see Pelosi with such skepticism.
Yeah, she finds that very frustrating, by the way, when progressives in her caucus think she's not liberal enough. She finds that that she does not appreciate that criticism, because it's not that she's not as liberal as they are, it's that she is pragmatic. I mean, that's the Baltimore Paul in Nancy Pelosi. She is more interested in getting something done than in taking a very principled stand. You know, for instance, you know, we saw this, I think, just last week when the Senate moved to have a doomed vote on trying to find a path to pass the voting rights bill. Now, Pelosi definitely supports the voting rights bill. She wishes it could be passed. She wishes it could get through the Senate. It did get through the House. She would never have brought that bill up to make a point. She does not like to bring bills up if she thinks they're going to go down. She is a very careful counter. I can't think of a time, I'm sure there's a case of this, but I can't think of, certainly on an important bill, that she's brought up and been defeated on the floor because she thinks that is not helpful in getting whatever it is you can get done. But there are progressives who thought that was the right thing to do last week, to force two Democratic senators to cast a vote that put them at odds with their colleagues.
Yeah, and her vote counting is mentioned throughout the book, whether it's on the floor for an important bill or in her early races for the leadership. You know, even in secret ballot vote, she had a good idea of how many votes she was going to get from her colleagues.
See, I think another lesson from her parents, and her view was, if someone says something friendly to you, that does not mean they'll vote for you. You need to get someone to explicitly commit. And then you need to really hold their feet to the fire to make them stand up to that. And I think that's, you know, as you know, these secret ballots that they have for votes for the leadership in the Congress, how many members of Congress have gone in certain they had a majority of votes only to fall short because people would say friendly things, but not in the end cast their vote for him. Nancy Pelosi takes, when Nancy Pelosi has a hard count, it is a hard count that she can count on.
Well, as you know, she, when she became whip, she, you know, almost had it down to the member in terms of the votes that she had counted. And people sort of recognized her legislative skill, but also her fundraising. And her fundraising is sort of a thread that continues throughout. She's raised more money for congressional candidates than any other party leader in history. But yet she didn't want to go the route of being DCCC chair first. She wanted to go straight in to the whip operation. So if you could sort of explain that and then also the role of fundraising and it plays and how it plays into her leadership.
You know, Catherine, she's raised $1 billion for congressional races. $1 billion. No congressional leader has ever raised that kind of money before. And she's done it with cultivation of big donors. Now, this is a criticism that some make of Pelosi, that she is very much a part of the system that cultivates big donors and gets big contributions from them. And you see somebody like AOC or Bernie Sanders, who has shown us that you can raise huge amounts of money with small donors. Maybe that's a better, in terms of our small D democracy, maybe that's a healthier for our system. That's not been the course that Pelosi has taken. You know, she's a wealthy woman in California, which is a mother lode of political contributions. She has deep ties with the tech community and with the Hollywood. And so she, fundraising has definitely been part of her secret of success. In fact, there was an academic study that looked at the race that she won for whip. Now, the whip doesn't sound like that great a job, only it puts you on the ladder to eventually become speaker. So very important job. And their analysis showed that whether members of Congress were female or male, that did not significantly affect their vote between Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer. But what did affect their vote was if they were from California or Maryland, and there Pelosi had a big advantage because more members from California than Maryland. And two, if they had gotten money from Pelosi or from Hoyer. And of course, Pelosi had a lot more money to give away than Steny Hoyer. Those are the two factors, not her gender, that got her on the track to be speaker.
Yeah, that is so interesting. And as you know, she was also so good at cultivating these relationships. But you also make a point that I think others have observed, that she's not as good of an orator. In fact, you write, and I'm quoting from your book, she was a master of the inside game of politics. She was never a compelling orator. She was so disciplined that she could seem robotic. How has that affected her career, or has that just been part of the balance of her strengths and weaknesses?
So, you know, Pelosi is a really tough interview. You know, I've interviewed a lot of Pauls. John McCain, love to interview him. You always come away with something really rich and interesting and spontaneous. Bill Clinton, he's a great interview. Nancy Pelosi, really tough because she doesn't, she wants to say what she wants to say, and that's what she's going to say. And it takes a lot of either effort or serendipitous timing to get her to say something she does not intend to say. I mean, what is the definition of a journalist's job? To get you to say something you didn't intend to say, but is true, right? So Pelosi makes it hard. She's not good at giving a big speech. She's not particularly good on the Sunday morning talk shows, interview shows. So it'd be hard for her, say, to run for president with those set of skills. But there is no one in American politics today who is more skilled than Nancy Pelosi at the inside game of drafting legislation, lobbying for legislation, and passing legislation. She is, I think, in the top rank in terms of consequence of American speakers in the history of the United States.
Yes, and I think the political scientists would certainly agree. And she has kept, as you note in the book as well, she has kept the party more unified than any other speaker, since we've had these party unity scores in probably ever. Certainly one of the most powerful speakers since Joe Cannon over 100 years ago.
You know, Catherine, I think that's because she not only knows how to get power, She has a purpose for her power. She wants to do something with power.
Yes.
So she has been willing to lose power in the interest of getting some big things done. So she's not only maintained her position at the as the most powerful Democrat in the House for nearly 20 years, but she's used it to push through the Affordable Care Act, for instance, and to impeach Donald Trump twice, and to push through a pretty unpopular bill in 2008 designed to kind of rescue the American financial system during that meltdown. And so those, and both that and the Affordable Care Act were measures that cost Democrats in the next election and the election after that. But she saw that as the purpose of gathering power to do something with it. And that's why I think you can agree that you can like what she does with it or not like it, but you can't disagree that she has been a master at that side of the craft of politics.
And say a little bit more, as you do in your book, about her critical yet underappreciated role in the passage of the Affordable Care Act.
I just loved reporting on that part of the book because I found out about this meeting that in the Oval Office that she had with President Obama. Now, they're trying to pass the Affordable Care Act. It's been hard. The Senate wouldn't move along very fast. And then there was a special election in Massachusetts and Democrats lost their 60th Senate vote, which meant they couldn't automatically block a filibuster. And there were a lot of Democrats, including Harry Reid, then the Senate Democratic leader, and Rahm Emanuel, who was then the White House chief of staff to Barack Obama, who thought they couldn't do a big bill. They had to do a small bill. It was going to be too hard to do a big bill. So they had a meeting, and that was not Pelosi's view. Pelosi's view was, I can get this through. We can get this through. You don't get many chances to do something this big. Let's not blow it. And she went into a White House meeting and did something I've never heard of any legislative leader ever doing before, not in modern times, to a president of their own party. She said to Obama, you know, so Rahm Emanuel, the chief of staff, argued for a small bill. And she said, you know, Mr. President, you can have a small bill, but I won't help you pass it. If you're going to have a small bill, you're going to be on your own. If you want to do a big bill, I'll work for you. This is in effect giving, it's just an extraordinary example of hardball politics. Can you imagine? And left Obama with no option. What was Obama going to do? He was not going to get a bill through the House, a small bill, even a pared down bill without Pelosi on his side. He had to go for the big bill. He says that when I interviewed Obama for the book, he said he had also believed they should go for the big bill, and that may well be true. But Pelosi did not give him the option of going for a small bill. And what Pelosi did then to get the Affordable Care Act through a divided House, get through the version that the Senate was willing to pass, was phenomenal.
Yeah, thank you. And let's pivot to that and talk more generally about Speaker Pelosi's role in sort of dealing with presidents, whether of her own party or the other party. As you note, you know, certainly with President Bush and then definitely with President Trump, I mean, they had a lot of conflict and her role with President Obama wasn't necessarily smooth all the time. So if you could talk about each of those presidents and how she sort of negotiated with them and then finally compare it to current President Biden.
So her, you know, she's very respectful of presidents. As you said, she is an institutionalist, but her relationship with George W. Bush was terrible because of the Iraq War. She told me that she thought the Iraq War was the biggest mistake in American history, which is saying a lot, and that George W. Bush was the worst president. So this is, when I asked her if her view had mellowed with the passage of time, and she said no. So she had a difficult relationship with George W. Bush. And when the financial meltdown came in 2008, the two of them had not spoken for months. That tells you how bad the relationship was. All their conversations were all through the Treasury Secretary, Hank Paulson. So she worked to rescue his presidency by helping him out during that financial meltdown, but she did not have much regard for him. Her relationship with Obama was, she revered him. She She admired his political skills. She didn't think he understood Congress very well, but she recognized that if the Affordable Care Act couldn't have gotten through without her, it also could not have gotten through without him. So I would say I think she just has huge respect and regard for Barack Obama and he for her. You know, Trump, what can you say? She allowed him to be impeached twice. She had a dyspeptic view of him from their first meeting in the White House after he had taken office. He had, you know, it was interesting. I interviewed him in 2018, not about Pelosi, but about what was going on in politics. And I asked him if he was concerned that Democrats were going to win the House, which it looked like they were going to do, and which would make Pelosi speaker. And he said no. He said he thought that there were ways he and Nancy could get along. He always called her Nancy. That there were ways in which there were things that he could get done with Democrats in control that he couldn't get done with Republicans in control, including a big infrastructure bill that he wanted and never got. Now, there were people on his staff who thought he was quite wrong in not being more worried about a Democratic takeover of the House. And he did turn out to be wrong, because once Democrats won the House and Pelosi became Speaker, it of course opened the door to endless investigations of President Trump and to impeachment. She viewed President Trump as a danger to American democracy. So now looking at Biden, she has a long relationship with Biden. She also views him, I think, with affection and respect, but I think she's been distressed by some of the missteps President Biden has made. And now they've gotten themselves all tangled up with this Build Back Better bill stalled in the Senate. Not at all clear what's going to happen with that.
Thank you. Sort of following up on what's going on right now, do you think that getting the House to both pass infrastructure and Build Back Better was sort of a bigger coup for Pelosi than has been recognized, given how she worked with the Progressive Caucus and the moderates and the CBC, sort of in getting everyone together?
Well, it was an example of her skill, even as the politics becomes, you know, she can only lose 4 or 5 Democratic votes and get things through. This is an impossibly small margin. So the fact that they passed the House, I think, is a sign of her continued skill in difficult circumstances. But I don't think she would view Build Back Better as a victory until they get a final version to the president. And that hasn't happened yet.
And do you get the sense that she is actively working behind the scenes with Democratic Majority Leader in the Senate, Chuck Schumer, and President Biden? Or is she sort of like, okay, the Senate, do your thing?
What would you guess the answer to that question?
She's there.
She's there. Yeah, that's right. I think that's the safe answer. And when President Biden at his news conference said that he was open to breaking up Build Back Better into smaller pieces, it was Pelosi who at her news conference last week noted that if you're trying to get it through using the parliamentary procedure known as reconciliation, you can't just break it up and push it through. It's more complicated than that. So I'm sure she is playing a really big role in figuring out what it is they can get through the Senate.
Great, yeah. One of the chapters that really piqued my interest was about the relationship that she has with the squad, Representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and then of course, Ilhan Omar from Minnesota, representing the district where the University of Minnesota is. And so if you could talk a little bit about that, both the challenges that the squad poses, but then also how Pelosi in some ways brought them into the fold.
So that's so interesting. So I didn't realize that Ilhan Omar represents the University of Minnesota. Isn't that interesting? And so do you ever hear her? Have you ever heard her? I'm sure that gives you opportunity to hear from her more often and in different settings. Does she ever talk about Pelosi?
Not that I can remember. I mean, she's been at the Humphrey Institute, which of course we're being hosted by now, but not that I can think of.
Well, that would be interesting, because one of the surprises when I was reporting out this book was that Pelosi and Ilhan Omar are pretty close personally. And it goes back to Pelosi's reassuring role when Omar was running the first time for Congress and was had various concerns. And Pelosi was extremely solicitous and helpful they built a real relationship. They have a real friendship, even though there are times they've been crosswise and Ilhan Omar has done things that's given Nancy Pelosi trouble. So I would be really curious the next time she's at the Humphrey Center, if you would ask her about that and let me know what she says.
Will do.
to go into the squad, you know, I mentioned that Pelosi is a tough interview, but I got to say the best interview I ever had with her for this book was, you know, these interviews would, I had 10 interviews with her for the book and they would be set up well in advance. Obviously because she's the Speaker of the House and has other things to do than talk to me. So one of the interviews I had with her was, happened to be right after a big blow up with the squad in the Democratic caucus, like behind closed doors, but loud enough to hear it across Washington. And she came to this interview all steamed up. And so I kept asking her about what had happened at the meeting and what did you think of the squad? And she was getting annoyed with me because that's not what she wanted to talk about. And she said, I thought you came here to talk about the book. And I said, well, I did, but let me just ask you one last question, which is a reporter's trick. I said, do you think the squad appreciates the process involved in making legislation that can pass, the kind of sausage making process? And that set her off because of course that's exactly what she thinks the squad doesn't understand, that they do not understand what you need to do and the kind of long-term calculations you need to make if you're actually going to get something done. And I got to say, she said that she quoted Dave Obey, the former congressman, who had a saying that some people come to Congress to pose for holy pictures and other people come to Congress to get things done. This was like one of his favorite sayings, and Pelosi liked it too. And she mimicked, she said, some people are here to pose for holy pictures. And she mimicked, you know, a child posing for holy pictures. This would be her reference to the squad. Mm-hmm. And other people come here to get things done. That would be a reference to herself. So that was a time when the scheduling of the interview helped me get a more spontaneous reaction from Speaker Pelosi.
That's great. That's great. Thank you. Speaker Pelosi has rewritten the script for women in leadership, as we started to talk about earlier. In many ways, her career runs counter to gender stereotypes. She's a fierce partisan. Gender stereotypes suggest that women are more likely to be bipartisan. She really doesn't work across party lines for the most part. She's the most prolific congressional fundraiser in history, as we've mentioned. And so how do you think this will help women in future leadership races? And how do you think more generally gender dynamics have paved the way or hurt her in more recent years? We talked about early years, but how does that affect her today?
So Catherine, I've got to say that you know more about this than I do. I know you're working on a book about gendered partisanship. I look forward to reading it when you're done. And here, I want to ask a question to you. One are the stereotypes of how women lead correct and Pelosi's an outlier, or does Pelosi show us that the stereotypes about how women lead is itself wrong?
I think the situation has changed. I think empirically, you can look at the late 80s, the early 90s, and women really were voting more likely to vote across the aisle, particularly Republican women, but women in both parties. But as parties have become stronger and parties determine so much of members' fates, I think members, male and female, have incentives to toe the party line. But because women have to overcome some of these gender stereotypes, that they're not agentic, they're not fierce partisans, perhaps some women have worked harder, but that is who Pelosi is. She is a fierce partisan. you know, she is a prolific fundraiser. So I don't know that she's necessarily trying to overcome a gender stereotype, but trying to do what's necessary to be an effective party leader in today's polarized era.
Well, and I wonder to the degree to which, and this is a question you could pose for women in journalism or academia or in politics, does the fact that Pelosi basically ignored expectations of how women were supposed to behave in Congress, does that make it easier for any other woman to follow in that path?
I think that's a great question. And I think probably the answer is yes. And one, it's so interesting. She clearly cares about women's issues. She talks about women's health a lot. She talks in the passage of the Affordable Care Act, you know, there was so much about healthcare access for women. Being a woman is no longer a pre-existing condition. But yet, you know, certainly some of her biggest sort of conflicts have been with other congresswomen. And so it is sort of the gender dynamics are interesting. There. Moving forward, I know you didn't cover this in your current book, but the paperback edition will. I want to talk about January 6th, which of course fundamentally altered the 117th Congress. In the immediate aftermath of a violent attack on the Capitol, 139 Republican members of the U.S. House voted to object to at least one state's Electoral College vote count. So could you share your perspective on how that has affected how the current Congress functions and Pelosi's leadership?
Well, it's had a big impact on the current Congress. I mean, I didn't think our partisan divide could get deeper or angrier, and it has. I don't see an end in sight. I mean, look at the relationship between Nancy Pelosi and Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader. You know, the leaders of the two parties in the House often haven't gotten along, but usually they've had a kind of working relationship. But these two do not. And they didn't really have a good working relationship before. But once McCarthy has embraced the big lie, the idea that the 2020 election was stolen from Donald Trump, that has just made them have no relationship at all. So these two sides have, you know, are for whatever the big problems facing the country, on COVID, on inflation, on climate change, there is nothing going on between the leaders of the two parties when it comes to those issues. And you know, you've got Democrats in Congress believing that this Republican attitude is a threat, not just to Democratic rule, but to Democratic rule, not just to the role that Democrats, the party, have, but to the future of our democracy. That's a pretty heavy thing. I think that when I did a piece about this, marking the 1 year anniversary of January 6th, and I talked to some historians who likened this to the Civil War, that you have to go back to the Civil War to find a time when our democratic institutions seem to be under such stress. And of course, even with the Civil War, we didn't see people parading through the Capitol carrying a Confederate flag.
And do you think that she has handled the January 6th committee as well as one could, or could she have done something different to make it more bipartisan?
So she very much wanted to have a nonpartisan commission or a bipartisan commission to investigate January 6th. And she actually, after she made a proposal that was kind of favored Democrats, when the Republicans in Congress wouldn't agree to that, she proposed something that was very even, Stephen, even number of members, both sides had subpoena power, and the Republicans turned that down. So I think in fairness, she went as far as she could go to get a truly bipartisan commission. But she still felt, and I interviewed her about this for USA Today, she still felt that it was important, crucial really, to find out what happened on January 6th, who was behind it, who financed it, who planned it, and what were they doing now? Because, you know, you do not get the sense that the challenges of January 6th are over now. That's when she set up the select committee that is really has two Republicans on it, but they've kind of defied their own leadership to participate in it. I think she deserves she's a fierce partisan and she gives no quarter to Republicans, but I think she has done what she could to try to make this a less partisan investigation. And of course, now they're working as fast as they can because we assume most likely Republicans will gain control of the House in November. And at that point, this investigation will be over. Catherine, I'd like to tell you about an interview I did with her that's in the paperback edition of the book, but the interview was after the hardback was out. So this was an interview really for USA Today. And I asked her if the rioters had caught her on January 6th, would they have killed her? And she said, yes, that was what they were trying to do. And then she said, but they would have had a fight on their hands because they would have had a battle on their hands because I'm a street fighter. And then she wears these stiletto heels. She lifted up one of her stiletto heels and said, besides, I could have used this as a weapon.
Wow. Wow. That speaks volumes. First, a quick question. What is her relationship like with Liz Cheney? Of course, one of the two Republicans on the Select Committee.
So when I was working on the book, I saw these parallels between Pelosi and Cheney in that the daughters of big political families, fiercely partisan, although in different parties, willing to defy, not really rising in the leadership because Cheney had been elected to the leadership, didn't really do a lot to cultivate, had kind of a tough exterior. I thought they were sort of alike. And I tried to interview Cheney about this. I sent a request into Cheney, who I'd interviewed a couple times before and other things, if I could interview her because I saw these parallels, and Cheney refused to talk to me about it. So Cheney didn't want to maybe encourage these parallels. They're politically, they're very different, right? They are, if you look at their partisan voting records, it is 100% different. It's hard to think of an issue on which they would hold similar views. But when it comes to their attention to democratic institutions and their respect for that, on that they have found common cause. And Liz Cheney has been hugely important to Pelosi's efforts to try to keep this January 6th investigation from being completely partisan.
Thank you. And one final question from me before I turn to audience questions. So for the audience, be sure to submit your questions in the Q&A. But thinking about the 2022 midterms and the next generation of Democratic leaders, has Speaker Pelosi done enough to cultivate the next generation of Democratic leaders, party leaders? And who do you think is in that mix in the next generation?
So this is, in Succession, everybody keeps waiting for the old guy to die. In politics, it could not die, but retire. Politicians are always calculating who next up, where could they be? And the problem that Pelosi has presented for any number of House Democrats is that she's hung on so long. I mean, she's held power for so long that there have been any number of members of the House who finally moved on to other endeavors, to the Senate or to running for statewide office, on the theory that they just couldn't count on Pelosi to ever kind of voluntarily get out of the way. We think that this is probably her last term in Congress, or last term as leader, although that's not guaranteed. That's the general assumption being made. And one of Pelosi's, the subtitle of my book is The Lessons of Power. The number one lesson of power for Nancy Pelosi is one that her father taught her, which is that no one will give you power, you have to seize it. And that is a rule that will apply when Pelosi leaves the scene and a new generation of Democratic leaders are elected. Nobody's gonna get handed this job. They're gonna have to fight for it. That said, the most likely, the favorite, the one we think is the front runner and favored to win the opportunity to lead the Democrats in the House when Pelosi leaves is Hakeem Jeffries, who is a congressman from New York now in the leadership. He would also be a groundbreaker in that he would be the first African-American to serve in such a senior role in the House leadership. But there are some other candidates who are interested in that as well. And so I think the Pelosi lesson would be, don't be too sure until you've actually counted your votes and they've been cast in that secret ballot.
Great, thank you. And following up with a question from the audience about future party leaders, just as Pelosi was more progressive earlier in her career than the average Democrat, so are the Squad. Do you see any of the Squad aspiring to party leadership positions?
Well, they could. I mean, certainly progressives do. The chair of the House Progressive Caucus, Congressman Jayapal is another person I think who could run for House Democratic leader and could be a formidable candidate because a number of progressives in the House, you know, the party has moved to the left. The Democratic Party has moved to the left, just as the Republican Party has moved to the right. And so progressives have a louder voice than they had before. You also have to think about, so who's the electorate in this election? And the electorate will be the Democrats who managed to win in this year's midterm elections. And if you assume, and nothing's guaranteed in politics, but history says that it's more moderate members of the House Democratic Caucus who are at greater risk of losing their seats in an election that favors Republicans. That means the Democratic Caucus would be smaller, but even more liberal than it is now. So a progressive candidate might well be a very serious contender for the leadership.
Thank you. As you note in the book, Pelosi does really try to meet with and do a good job for looking out for those more moderate Democrats in her caucus. But that's not necessarily visible. And we have a questioner who writes, as a Democrat, I admire a number of Speaker Pelosi's accomplishments, but as a Midwestern Democrat, I believe that having essentially someone who can be branded as a limousine liberal and a coastal elite hurts Democrats, especially as the Midwestern blue wall has all but collapsed. What do you think Pelosi's response would be to this criticism?
You know, we talked before about how much money Pelosi has raised for Democrats. Pelosi has also raised a bunch of money for Republicans because she is the favorite demon, the favorite villain for Republicans and has been for decades. And that's because she's liberal. And I think it's because she's female and because she comes from San Francisco with all the cultural overtones that carries. And so there may be ways in which that has been unhelpful to Democrats running in places like Minnesota or my home state of Kansas. On the other hand, the House races are particular things. And I wonder if maybe you would have a smarter view of this, Catherine, than I do, whether who is the speaker or who is the Democratic leader affects the outcome of individual House races. Now, maybe it does, because certainly lots of Republicans run lots of ads in individual races that picture Pelosi in the most negative possible ways. Do you think, Catherine, that has an impact on the outcome of those House races?
Well, certainly scholarship has shown that over and over again, national politics has really pervaded congressional elections, which used to be local referendums on the incumbent. They have now become nationalized. And so a party tide is going to affect all candidates of that party. You know, at the margins, can candidates do things to insulate themselves from say a Speaker Pelosi or their party by saying, you know, as Jason Crow did, I'm not going to vote for Pelosi for Speaker, coming from this moderate district. Yes, and maybe that helps at the margins, but in a national tide, I don't think distancing oneself from Pelosi or having a more sort of visibly moderate party leader is really going to help all that much.
And of course, we know that one of the big determinants of the outcome of off-year midterms, like the one we're coming up, is the approval rating of the president. Exactly. When you have a president in your own party who is unpopular, we know that hurts House candidates in that party, whether they tried to associate themselves with him or not. I don't know if I think speakers have the same power, but maybe they do. Maybe it's part of that general impression that voters get of where a party stands.
Yeah, I mean, as you note, in a midterm election, you know, of the vast majority of voters actually say it's a referendum on the president, even though the president's not on the ballot. So I think 2022 will primarily be about Joe Biden and the extent to which he inserts himself, Donald Trump. So this is an interesting question that is not about Speaker Pelosi, but it is, what future role do you envision for Senator Amy Klobuchar, the Supreme Court, party leader in the Senate?
You know, Klobuchar has been interesting and been very active, and she's one of the few members of Congress who has managed to, on several occasions, work across party lines to get something done or to push something. So, she had a kind of a rough patch after she ran during her presidential campaign. I mean, a wonderful announcement in the snow, right? Who can forget that? But then a rough patch as the campaign went on, some questions about some of her history in Minnesota politics. But I see her as someone who's got huge potential. And I always kind of assume that if you run for president once, you'd like to run for president again. So, because that's been the case with a lot of people who've run for president. So she ran for president once, maybe she'd like to run for president again.
She has many years in her career left. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. This is a question coming to us from a real campaign expert, and that is, Speaker Pelosi has helped change the face of power in Congress, not only by her leadership position, but also getting more women and other people from BIPOC communities to run for office. Did you talk to women that Speaker Pelosi recruited to run for Congress? And can you talk to us about her approach and most effective tactics?
Yeah, it's definitely been something she's tried hard to do. Were there like 25 members of Congress when she was elected to Congress? Can you imagine how small that number was? And she has done a lot to recruit diverse and female candidates for office. And one of the things she says to female candidates, you know, historically it's been harder to get women to run than to get men to run for office. And one of the classic things that's happened is that political parties have tried to recruit women to run for office, and they say, I'm not qualified, somebody else will do it better. And Pelosi would say that the best training she had to be a member of, to be Speaker of the House, was to run her own house. That having five children, as she did, was the best possible training for figuring out how to operate in a political world. And the causes that she cares about most, she always says children are her primary cause, the thing that motivates her in politics, that also relates to the role that she had as a wife and mother. So that is one of the arguments that she has made to women to encourage them to run for office. And she's also done things like, this was early in her career, where she would invite, if they're trying to recruit a candidate, she doesn't do this, I think, as speaker, but before she was such a power in the leadership, she would invite reluctant women candidates to come spend a day with her, see what it's like being a member of Congress, as part of the process of making female, to convince more women to actually take the plunge and run.
That one other thing I've noticed sort of observing Congress is that Speaker Pelosi has made a huge effort to ensure that more women of color, more people of color more generally are on key committees and key positions. And that's really something that she's done throughout her career as a leader, whereas previous Democratic leaders really have not done that. If you could comment on that.
Well, of course, just come tell us what your concerns are, your women, and we'll take care of them for you. That's not, didn't work with Pelosi when she was starting out. And she has, I mean, one of the things that Pelosi has in Congress with Newt Gingrich is, when Gingrich became speaker after the 1994 midterms, he really consolidated power in the speakership in a big way, including the power to appoint people to committees and the power to instruct committee chairs on what it was they were supposed to do. That is something that Pelosi has continued, and she's really consolidated her power. When we're discussing things like, will the House impeach Trump, there was no need to talk to anybody but Pelosi, because that was a decision that was going to be decided by her. And even when she named the first impeachment team, House impeachment prosecutors, she didn't even tell the other members of the leadership who they were going to be until she was about to announce the names. That's Catherine, I think that's going to be something interesting to watch with the next Democratic leader, whether in the next speaker, Republican or Democrat, but among Democrats, I think there may be a move to have the speakership be a little less the center of all power, disperse power a little more, the committees, but we'll see.
I am following up on one of our questioners earlier, who actually writes, Pelosi spent some time with me talking about her time as a staffer and political leader, and ended it by asking me if I would be ready to run when it was my time. So
did that person run?
On that.
Did that person run?
Not yet, but I expect they will. I'll keep you posted. that's That's great. Another questioner writes, by chance, my kids and I met Speaker Pelosi one day, literally in the middle of the street. My kids were elementary aged and she went right into grandmother mode and could not have been kinder to them. Why don't we see this side of her more often?
Yeah, I mean, it's true. She doesn't show that side much. I mean, when she was in her 70s, she took two of her grandsons to see a Metallica concert at Central Park. You know, that's not a side of Pelosi that you see much either. She has 5 kids. She has 9 grandchildren. She is very close to them. They have a family message stream that she's very active on. Apparently, quite a few emojis from Nancy Pelosi to her grandchildren. But it's not something that she shows in public very often. And perhaps that's hurt her, that doesn't make herself vulnerable in that way. On the other hand, her style has enabled her to get power and to keep it and to use it. So there's that.
Sort of switching gears, a questioner asks, do you see Pelosi caving on the current effort to ban stock trading by members of Congress? Mm.
That's a great question, because she has a strong personal view that members should be allowed to trade stocks. And she has her family, her husband trades a lot of stocks. That's sometimes been controversial. But there is a rising concern that members of Congress, not Pelosi, but other members of Congress, have abused the information they get in Congress to make stock trades in advance, which sure sounds like insider trading to the rest of us. Mm-hmm. And there is definitely a rising sentiment in Congress to try to do something about this. So I'll be interested to see what she does about that issue.
Going forward. How do you see the rest of the 117th Congress playing out, if it is indeed Speaker Pelosi's last Congress being Speaker? Obviously, passing the Build Better Act is very important to her. Sort of what do you see happening in the final chapter?
Well, I think she thinks they only have a few weeks or months left to actually get things done. Because as you know, Catherine, what happens is the weather starts to get warm and we will be into campaign mode and the kind of fierce campaign mode that, you know, like Katie barred the door. So I think she thinks they have a limited amount of time to get things done. I know she'd like to get a version of Build Back Better through the Senate, as she is very aware of the parliamentary challenges to doing that, because there's almost no chance of overcoming a Senate filibuster. But not impossible. She's very concerned, I think, about climate change. That would be a part of the Build Back Better Act that she would very much like to see get enacted. But at that point, she will go into the campaign mode she's been in before of trying to protect and elect Democrats. It looks like this is going to be a very tough year to do that. We're watching, Catherine, also for an announcement on her part. You know, the California on February 14th, some people think of that as Valentine's Day. We think of that as the day when people can start to file to get their name on the primaries in California. And so sometime in that period of from February 14th to, I think, March 11th, she will need to say whether she's going to be run for another term in Congress. And the betting is that she will file, run again, win, by the way, and after that, possibly resign, prompting a special election, that she won't, in fact, not file again and let that race open up in San Francisco, because it wouldn't be helpful in terms of her campaigning and her raising money and all that. But either way, so anyway, that's a little something we're all watching for on the Pelosi front over the next couple of weeks.
We will stay tuned. And I'm going to turn the microphone back over to Larry Jacobs, but I just want to thank you so much for all of these insightful answers to your question. And your book is awesome. So thank you.
Catherine, thank you so much.
And thank you, Catherine. This has been a terrific conversation with Susan Page, who is the Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. You can see today why Susan Page is one of the most widely read and respected journalist. He's also a best-selling author, most recently of Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi and the Lessons of Power. And before that, The Matriarch, Barbara Bush and the Making of an American Dynasty. I highly recommend both books. Susan Page, thank you so much for joining us. This has really been just an extraordinary conversation that many of us have learned from.
Thank you.
I want to just take a moment to quickly mention upcoming event. We have Glenn Lowry, who is a professor at Brown University and a well-known conservative critic of kind of traditional civil rights legislation. He's challenged what is often the conventional view about sources of poverty. For Professor Lowry, he has linked it to the dysfunction and violence in the Black community. He's also challenged affirmative action. He's very smart, very provocative, and quite controversial. He'll be joined by econ professor here at DU, Christopher Phelan. This will be a great conversation. Please check it out, February 3rd at noon. It's being brought to us by the College of Liberal Arts. And also we are co-sponsoring it, which I'm very proud of. If you enjoyed today's program, you can get a recording of it. It will be available as a YouTube broadcast and also as a podcast on all your favorite stations. It'll be up in a day or two. Look for that. Also, I want to just let you know that all these programs are brought to you free and they're open to the public. Of course, we welcome financial support. If you'd like to join our donor circle, please get in touch with us. Once again, Susan Page, thank you so much for this terrific conversation.
Hey, Larry, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Take care. You all have a good day.